If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Can I ask you something? What's your family's story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. Today, I have a special guest from the UK. Welcome to the Vietnamese podcast. I have Dam Van Huynh. And before we go on, I just have to call out the elephant in the room because this has been on my mind for the last week when I'm preparing to interview you. There is a famous singer in Vietnam and his name is Dam Van Huynh. And I'm like, okay, I have to confront this because I have these speech issues when I have these crossovers and it becomes a problem. So Dom, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Kenneth. Yes, it's a pleasure. Obviously, I've looked at some of your works online and yeah, it's just really amazing, really appreciative of the work you do. And yes, this is a fairly recent encounter in terms of every time I go back to Vietnam, everyone associates my name with the singer. And I confess, I've not really heard his music. So I'm just going to assume it's good music.
Yeah, I don't know who I can really compare him to, but I would say maybe the Elton John of Vietnam. I mean, not the style of music, but the popularity and the sort of the flamboyancy, the big name. He's been around for a long time and, you know, he's got a presence.
I don't mind being associated with a large name. I'll be okay with that.
So, Dom, we're going to talk about a lot of things today. I think you cannot separate your work from politics, and we will get into that because I think art does reflect politics and politics reflects art many times, but we will get into that. And before we get into that story, I'd love to know how your family and yourself landed in the UK.
And actually, it's a bit more complex than that. So we originally landed in the US. So I grew up a little bit when I was younger in the US. And it's just I'd been outside of the US longer than I'd been in the US. So if you have a group of diaspora Vietnamese from the Vietnamese diaspora who are already kind of having identity and questions insofar as themselves in positioning into America, well, I'm even another step confused because then I've made another journey across more to Europe, and then particularly I've made the UK my home. So I still have family in the States. And so, yes, we landed there in America when I was around 7. And my family now is settled in California. I'm my immediate family. And I myself, through the arts, have kind of migrated across and worked in various companies in the States when I was much younger. And then eventually I've just settled here in London. And so I've got a bit of a journey there.
Wow. So how old were you when you left the US?
Well, let's see. I arrived there when I was around 7 or 8. And then I started because, you know, in the field of dance, they kind of take us quite young. So I joined my first professional company when I was 17. And so I left and eventually I started working in a couple of states. And then I was here in, I would say, before 20, in my early 20s here. And I've lived here for over 20 something years, 25 years or something.
You look like you're 25. What do you mean?
Oh, thank you. Now you're my new best friend.
Yeah, because I was doing the math. I'm like, this is impossible that, yeah, it's like, you look like you're 25 and, you know.
Oh, so. Thank you. Yeah, brilliant. Thank you.
So,
no, do you much older than that.
The last time I had a dancer choreographer on the podcast was with Tang Dao. Do you know who?
Oh, yes. Oddly, a very good childhood friend of mine. We grew up together in the same neighborhood. We started dancing together. We trained together. And yeah, so we've deviated in terms of our journey. But yeah, that's a not like a like a brotherly, spiritual, brother forever type best friend growing up. Yeah, oddly.
I am getting goosebumps thinking about that. Coming from the same, so you grew up in LA, and did you go to the same high school that he was dancing at?
Exactly. So, you know, in LA, there's that extraordinary program called the High School for the Performing Arts, or the Los Angeles County High School for the Performing Arts. And yeah, it's just an extraordinary program that that made the arts public as opposed to a private act. And I think that's kind of, it's given a lot of opportunities for kids to have access to the arts where they would not have the opportunity. Yeah. So we went and we trained there together, and yeah, we trained in Boston together. So yeah, we've got a long history. Yeah. The world is small. In fairness, if you go back a couple of decades and then post that kind of rush of refugees who kind of settled in the US. You know, with Vietnamese parents, we really only have four professions that most of our children are allowed to go into, which is a doctor, lawyer, accountant, or some sort. So there wasn't that many who would have deviated into the arts. And so, yes, it's surprising. And yes, the world is very small, but there's only so many of us back then. And I think now it's been really a pleasure to see more young Vietnamese artists accessing and doing amazing works. But yeah, 2-3 decades ago, it was even fewer of us. So,
yeah, I mean, you two are both at the forefront of the dancing and the choreography. And you guys are, I mean, yeah, I'm at a loss of words for the journey of you and Tang Dao. You know, it's crazy. Because I always equate him to just being the only one, you know?
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And I think there's another
one. I could see why. You know, it's dancing is a very niche field anyways. And then you've got contemporary dance, and then, you know, that gets even more narrow. And so I could see why you know, it's really rare to come across one of us.
Yeah.
So, yeah, two of us.
But this is not about Tang. This is about Dom.
I know. But I'd like to send appreciation to Tang himself. Obviously, he's an extraordinary artist. And, you know, we trained together. He was a very gifted dancer as well. And, you know, he's doing great work as well. So
let me ask you this. What do you think made you get into dance? You came at 7 years old, and by 10 years into being in this new country, I don't even think your English was even probably strong enough at that time, right?
Indeed, yes.
Right? What made you go into this path of dancing?
Well, it's really amazing that this conversation has unfolded organically, because every time I tell this story, everyone's always like, who is this person and how? And honestly, actually, because you were saying it's not about Tang, but it is about him, because actually he was my best friend growing up. And one day, he's always been a pioneer. So, this, you know, I've got a lot of respect for him. One day he said, Dom, let's go take a dance class. And I said, oh, you know, at the time I was taking music lessons. And I thought, oh, dance is really not for me. You know, it's not really my thing. The whole cliche scenario. And he went. But the problem when you have a best childhood friend growing up, when they go somewhere on a weekend, it was every Saturday. And then when he went, well, I was stuck at home doing nothing, just kind of pissing about. And so then I thought, well, I might as well just join him. And so, yeah, that's the instigation of how I got into it. And, you know, it was, again, you know, there was a program that, again, I have to be grateful that it existed. It was set up by volunteer artists. And you could just go for free. And their mission was really to try to give inner city kids an opportunity to gain access to the arts. And I guess partially to keep us off the streets and focus on something productive. And that's kind of how I entered the field of dance. I fell in love with it. And then from there, just everything snowballed very fast. And here we are.
Yeah.
So years later.
I want to get to my selfish questions before I get to the main entree. Yes. I often think about these kind of selfish questions for myself and for my children and for other kids that are growing up today that are really torn between going into a creative field. If you go into singing, there's a chance that you could go around town and make money by doing session work and whatever that is, you teach. But when you go into dance, it is an unhealthy amount of worry as a parent for where I'm saying my daughter is begging to get into dance, and I will have to send her into it and hope that she doesn't flip the switch and say, I'm doing this. And I'm a very open-minded parent, but it's scary for me. And was that something that you had to contend with? And all these years, obviously you've made a living and you're alive, and I'm sure life is good and potential deals open up. And I want to hear about that side of it, the economics of it for you.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are a few kind of lines of thinking there, and I'll just maybe distill them to one or two so we can kind of focus the conversation a bit. But I think it's like many things that if you think about some things too intellectually, they don't make sense, and it's unlikely you would do it. You know, I would have to say, I could argue that having children, if you intellectualize that, nobody would have children. But the truth is, there, I think, you know, for things like the arts and then particularly in dance, it's just something that was, I'd like to avoid the word cliche, you know, the cliche word of passion, but you know, it just was something that once I had an encounter with the art form, it really resonated with me. It kind of took hold of me, and it became what I would consider a positive obsession that has never let go. And you know, that was something years ago when I was just 13 or 14. And you know, I think I couldn't even stop it, even if I tried. Wow. I have tried. I did. Wow. Try. And it's you know, I generally believe, and this is a very kind of ethereal philosophical statement, but you know, you generally don't choose the arts. The arts chooses you, and that is it. And you keep going with it. And so I think that's that. You know, that kind of intensity was really, I must confess, it wasn't even the dancing that did something for me particularly, but it was the form and how it gave me that sense of confidence, that ability to come out of myself. I would still consider myself a very shy, I would say an introvert of some sort. And you know, when I engage in the act of dancing and in the art form, none of it exists, and I am someone else, and someone else that I really appreciate and admire. And I think these things are more important for children actually than anything else. And so I think there's a lot of positivity that comes with it. And then, so I think that's one pathway. And then I'm going to put on another hat, because I used to be the head of contemporary dance in Hong Kong. There's a very large conservatoire there, and I was running the program for about 5 years. And one has to also imagine that the field of dance now is much broader than the old days. I think the old days, there was this really one of two avenues. You either go directly into large companies, you dance, and that's what you did as a profession. And or you might shift into either running a company or working in other areas. But now the dance field is so wide and eclectic. I think as an industry, you can go through to so many different career paths and opportunities. You can go into dance and well-being. They also have movement and psychotherapy for children, community dance and community work. So actually the field is broader than one assumes it would be, yes.
So you have a new show coming out October 10th. It's called Exquisite Noise. What was your inspiration for this show?
Yes, our premiere, in the London premiere, actually, the work has been, Exquisite Noise has been on tour for about 2 years now, across the UK and internationally, and now it's coming back to London for the first time. The work, I've been working with contemporary new music and sound arts with various collaborators for, I think, more than a decade now. And so I think working with sound and noise is quite comfortable and for me. And I mean, the general theme that I was working with was looking at noise as a form of activism. And that also embodies like visual noise and so forth. And I think the inspiration came at a time when I was living in various locations, and because I was also working in and living in Hong Kong during the social unrest at that time. And there was a lot of activities in the East and Southeast region as well. In Myanmar, there was that huge coup, and there was lots of activities that were very interesting that the wider community generally took to using pots and pans to make noise, because at some points they weren't able to utilize words anymore, because words at that point, I think at some point in certain societies when they're degrading, and they tend to become politicized. And so most people are afraid to speak, and obviously self-censorship and so forth, through fear and so forth. And so they would take to using noise to express their dissatisfaction of a government or an action or a policy. And this is not just something new. This has been happening all throughout history. In South America as well, and when I was in Hong Kong, at some point I think there was a larger kind of suppression of words. And something that was unique that was happening was that every night at 8 o'clock, everyone was banging on every object they could outside their windows and trying to make as much of a cacophonous soundscape as possible to kind of make a statement. And I think for me, this kind of, I guess it awoken a thought inside me on how one could utilize a mechanism like noise as a way to communicate something. And so hence the title Exquisite Noise. And I guess also generally through the research, the idea was looking at something like noise not being longing to any particular one or anything. It means that any one of us could access noise. And so that was the core of the research, and that's how we began the research in the early, maybe 2-3 years ago with my company here in the UK.
So I hear the theme. I understand where it comes from. How do you build a story? How do you build a whole show around that?
It's always a good question, because I think that's kind of generally the first go-to question when people ask about how do you make a work. I guess the truth is, maybe I think what I compare it with is in a way that obviously perhaps is relatable to yourself as well. You know, being a first generation, or even not even first generation, a 0.5 generation immigrant from the refugee experience, I tried to describe for many people the inability to describe with clarity who I am. There's this kind of general uncertainty as I try to negotiate or reconcile many aspects of myself, and you know, the society I live in or not live in, as a result of being an other and looking always in a sense of looking from outside, looking in. For me, it's always been difficult, because there are some days I can reconcile some aspects. You know, I'm utilizing English to express myself, to try to understand an identity of my very Vietnamese self that really is very, very prominent. And some days I think I'm able to reconcile that, but other days I wake up and they're not able to work together. And so sometimes I like to describe for people that when I construct a work, it pairs similarly to how I perceive myself, that the core of it is a little bit undefined, and that could take me a lifetime to try to work out. But what I can do is, starting from where I could remember and consciousness kicked in terms of trying to reflect upon the lived journey as a child refugee, I can construct an outline, an outlinear, or an etching of something outside of what I can understand. And then I try to leave that between myself and the audience to make a judgment for themselves what the central core, the subject of who I am or my work or my theme is. And then I leave it there as a provocation. So I generally don't develop linear or kind of from A to B dramaturgical approaches. I kind of do construct a lot of what I call a collaging approach of things that provoke thoughts and ideas pertaining to a topic.
I know why this is important to me, but I would love to hear why you think this is important to not just you, but for humanity to kind of experience.
I just think it's urgent, not just because it's from me, but also it's urgent because I'm sad to make a statement that history is continually working in a circular nature, and that we've learned very little in the time that we've progressed, unfortunately. And so, having gone through such an experience, and coming from the post-war experience into the refugee status, I've been there. I understand the precariousness and the challenges one has to encounter as a displaced person. And so it isn't a story that's just mine. It's generally universal. I think this is across the planet. I would say someone or at some point in their lives would have been a refugee of some sort. And you can really broaden the word refugee to not just someone who has to flee, but also the notion of refuge. One has to seek a refuge of some sort, and that could be someone looking for a safe haven from domestic abuse. And and so all these things are really important to discuss, because it is currently what is making up, unfortunately, the map and the picture of humanity. And so this is, it affects all of us.
And this is happening all over the world, not just in the United States and the UK, but like you said, Myanmar and Hong Kong. And there's a lot of different perspectives in every country you go to, but they all seem to kind of mirror and parallel each other. There's a lot of differences. And you want to bring us all together despite the differences, and you're doing it through dance. And when I think about that as the root of why you bring people together, I think about how difficult that really is, to kind of conjure up physical embodiment through dance of that idea of bringing people together. Can you kind of walk me through, because I won't be able to go to your show, but can you kind of walk me through a visualization of what I would expect if I was able to go to the show?
Yeah. I mean, I first I'd like to point out that I'm an eternal optimist, and I do genuinely believe that as a race, as a humanity, as a species, we will find a way out of all this. And I know we're going through some dynamic and evolution and development as a species, because every culture is emerging from different spaces, and obviously inequality and deliberate inequalities are causing instability. But I think...
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk. Crazy weather we're having. No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Maybe perhaps the best way to think about it is that most often my work is, I make political statements because it's actually at the core of it, I am more after the urgency of provoking continued conversations, continued dialogues, because I think it's only through these dialogues that we're able to kind of unite and find clarity. And for me, I am definitely not shy in terms of having confrontational or uncomfortable conversations. And so this mirrors very much, if you attend the show, you could see I do provoke and I do paint physical or I paint images through physical language that can conjure dystopian structures or destructive thoughts. And I do quote from other greater artists than myself who really have been proactive in terms of the activist work. You know, I've been inspired a lot by writers like Itsuya Yamada, who was a Japanese-American writer who had gone through the Japanese internment camp. She was talking about what it was like to be invisible. And she made this beautiful quote about invisibility not being a natural state for anyone. And you know, this, as she continues to discuss this, you can understand how we are in the same position we are basically back then. And so I quote these artists, I conjure them up into the space. So you will hear their thoughts depicted across and kind of interwoven through the experience. And at the same time, I also utilize words from great writers like Jenny Holzer's, who really, she wrote a series of what she calls inflammatory essays, where she just really basically rips into government structures that are just destructive and quite dark for a society. And you know, and she also kind of describes situations where one should move from being object needs to move away from being object into subject, so that you could really talk about something and make a clear point, because to continually be an object, one always gets pushed around and really just utilized as such. And so I think me interweaving thoughts from other activists and other artists who have come before me, and then grounding that with physical languages that describes scenes that are both supportive. So you can see the dancers moving through space where they guide and navigate each other in a communal structure. And then you can also see depictions of them deconstructing themselves as if there are pressure and weights upon them. And I think it's this constant interweaving of these thoughts that, again, invoke and provoke thoughts for people to kind of think and perhaps conjure in their imagination what this theme could be.
This has been going on for 2 years and now finally landing in London, right? Has the show changed at all in the 2 years?
It's changed a lot, yes, I think, and also because the evolution of the geopolitical landscape has shifted.
So we
have adopted new quotes to kind of update them. And I think also with 2 years of development and obviously sitting into work, the artists themselves are starting to negotiate the reality of our current social climate as well, and then embodying that into the work. So they are then themselves reflecting back and forth between the art and reality.
Yeah.
And so, yes.
So we'll segue into the Cambodian and the Laotian community through your work with Center 151. Can you tell me about that experience?
So Center 151, I'm currently the director of Center 151, and it actually, the history is really interesting. It originally was a home for refugees from Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, actually. And for about 40 years ago, there was obviously a large influx of refugees from that region because, of course, we know historically there was a large political situation that had occurred there. And obviously there was a huge influx here, and the government really made an initiative to allow these communities to galvanize for themselves and find ways to unite and perhaps find governance for themselves and so forth. And so they were given this home space where they've been housed, and again, a refuge, a space for them to come and gather and keep their culture and so forth. And I encountered them, the organization, about 10 years ago, and actually oddly coming to learn Vietnamese, but very precariously learning Vietnamese from the very start. So me at 30, something, I can't remember then. I walked in, I said, I'd like to learn Vietnamese from the start. So if you can put me into the first grade, please, that would be lovely. Because I generally felt that I speak the language, but there are very crucial periods in your life that the language becomes tangible and they become precious and magical when you are a child, and when you learn songs and when you learn folk tales and so forth. And I wanted that experience, and so I wanted to go backwards to investigate this. And so I arrived there, and I think they thought I was crazy, but they were very kind, and they said, okay, you can maybe you can't go at the beginning, but we'll put you in the first grade and see how you feel. And so I went and I learned Vietnamese with the children of the first grade groups at the center. And, you know, oddly, they are adults now. They've gone to university, and they still see me as classmates, even though I run the organization. And it's a beautiful experience, I have to say. And anyways, well, long story short, I got to know them, and I said, well, what do you do here? And I've come to learn that after 30 something years, there was a huge depletion of funding. The narrative of refugees had shifted away from East and Southeast Asia. The fashionable focus was much more in the Middle East, and so there was no more money and no more funding for these organizations that had set up themselves 40, 30 something years ago. And so I said, well, they really needed a way to go forward, but I think there wasn't an opportunity. And so I worked with the chairman of the organization to say, look, perhaps I propose an innovative way where my company is an arts company and you are a community center space that has a tangible physical space, perhaps a model where we can merge our resources to sustain and find a way to go forward together. And so this is the model that we're working with, where the company has an infrastructure, we run and work with them to keep the sustaining functioning of the organization. Our main aim is to try to obviously bring strategic aim to the organization, but also bring the arts to the community where they feel they can't access the arts. And in return, they offer us a safe haven, a refuge, again, this notion of a refuge and a home where we can develop. And this model has been working for the past 10 years. I do a lot of work. I would say a lot of my work as a director there is to try to be sensitive to the trustees, most of whom are the original refugees from that experience. And lots of the work is to try to understand and listen carefully where they want to go, what's the legacy they wish to leave And to ethically, how do we ethically guide the older generation who worked very hard, diligently to keep the community going for 30, 40 years? And so now they are in their latter part of their lives. How do we sustain and make their lives, you know, the quality of lives rich and rewarding? So that's, I think, a lot of my work is to engage in this practice. And I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot more nuance, but that's the general gist of that one.
With the center, it's a physical building that has been around for 40 years?
It is a physical building. It's not small and it's not large. So it's a very decent size space. And it sits in the heart of London in a very beautiful area called Hackney. And if you ever get a chance to come to London, you can see us in action. But maybe I should also, I think it's important to share that the vision that I've set out working with the trustees is the idea of narrative is really important for me. This idea that we are able to narrate for ourselves our story. I think for a long time, it has always been someone else narrating the story of the refugees who arrived. And so I have learned as I've gotten older that narrative is really important. And so the idea for us now is that, you know, you've got this group of refugees who have arrived in the host country and have been generously supported by the host country, and rightfully so, for a long time had to preserve their culture because they were in a precarious situation. And so uniting and preservation was really important. But now they themselves are doing well. Their children are well situated and acclimatized and very integrated into mainstream society and contributing extraordinarily across the field within society. And so the narrative for us now is that we are able to give back to the community. So really trying to be very clear to paint a picture that immigration and refugees are, again, in opposition to mainstream narrative, that is a negative thing, but actually that we are positively contributing with our culture and again, integrating successfully into society and giving back. And so for us, the center is now outward thinking in terms of including wider the community. And again, redefining the word refugee to embody the notion of refuge. So making that house, that very large house, a space for people to come if they feel they need a haven. So that's kind of the how we operate.
Have you been back to Vietnam?
Yes, I've been back to Vietnam quite a few times. And actually, I have a full commitment now after my 5 years working in Hong Kong. I have a firm commitment to trying to go back to Vietnam and really sharing whatever skills and knowledge I have. And so I've committed to a 5 to 10 years plan to be more present in the country. And that's as far as I've got with that.
So it sounds like a lot of your work and your life and your themes revolve around a lot of sort of activist work and being in community. What I've learned just by listening to the other side, the conservatives in my country, in the US, is that some of the values of the white folks, and now, you know, a lot of the values of the white folks are now being adopted by Vietnamese Americans because after 50 years, we've become that. So there's a lot of supporters, you know, for the current administration, the Trump administration. And when I put my ears to the ground to listen to what they have to say, I understand they want to preserve a way of life that they really worked hard for. But being progressives, like I think you and I come from the same sort of, we come from the same bloodline with that. Mm-hmm. Where do we find community together in fairness, because we understand that they have, I mean, this is the confusing part of, I think, the modern age, is that we need to identify now is where the factions are actually meeting in this time, in this day and age, because when you get an influx of migrants from another place, like Muslims or these other Middle East countries into Europe and the UK, it changes the fabric of the community. And for people like us, who I would say we're benefiting from the adjacency of being, you know, white adjacent, how do you as an artist really grapple with understanding the other side and kind of being fair? Because that's what I kind of try to do, and not shut out the right and the conservatives, and kind of understand where they're coming from.
I mean, I think that comment or that question is obviously a large, very complicated discussion. I think the root of it all is, I must confess, and I appreciate that you have a very proactive attempt at trying to understand and listening to the viewpoints. I think we've lost the understanding and the general principle of the democratic structure. And I think now it has really degraded to a sense of my team versus your team. It's the opposite of this. And if anything, for me, when I think of the principle, the founding foundation, the core of what democracy means, is that we should be able to get into a room and really scream at the top of our lungs about positions that we genuinely believe in. And it should be my attempt to try to persuade you to understand where I'm positioned, and you should do the same thing. It might get ugly, it might get really passionate, and it might be voluminous, and the volume might raise a bit. But at the end of that day, we're going to go and have a cup of coffee, because you're generally still in the same belief. You are one nation, one country that should have the same core value. And so I think, without understanding this, that it is okay to have disagreements, and that is, it is okay to have oppositional views, because that is the way the founding fathers would have desired that. Because if not, you would have had another model, which is a dictatorship or a monarchy format, where you have no say. And so it is okay. I think, first of all, let's acknowledge that it is okay to have disagreements and really have extreme viewpoints. But again, we cannot shy away from these discussions because it makes us uncomfortable, or because I just don't believe in what you're saying, and that I'm going to stick my fingers in my ears, and that we're just going to never speak to each other. It is the antithesis of what a democratic structure is. And so I think we first have to recognize that. And I think in terms of, history is complex, but at the same time, it's such a roadmap for where and how we could find ourselves. And that anytime you see a society that utilizes immigrants or a minority group as a scapegoat, wow, run, scream, make noise, make exquisite noise, to plug that one back in, because that is the first sign that we are going into a dark direction for our society. Because actually, time and time again, we have learned that immigration always contributes to a society. And I think at the moment, without getting so deep into the kind of political structure, it isn't the immigrants, it's the multi-billionaires who have created an unequal model that causes people to shift in huge influxes. And the idea of painting the immigrants as the reason for all the problems is ridiculous, in my humble opinion. I forgot the name of the author, but there's an interesting book, and the title essentially is "We Are Here Because You Were There." And the reason why there's a huge influx of immigration is because these multi-billion dollar corporations are there doing something that is unethical, causing havoc on humanity, causing huge influx of people to go here And so we need to talk about that. And so that I'm going to leave it there because, again, it's going to get very complex. And, well, I just give you an idea of two viewpoints that I think are very important when we have these discussions.
And you know, the crazy thing is, this has been going on for thousands of years. It's not going to end. But the scary thing is, we are living in this time and we are seeing perhaps the start of something much darker, a darker cycle of all of this. And many times when we think about this, this is not even, it might not even be a racial thing as much as it is a class thing.
Completely. It's completely a class thing. And I think both those who are positioned on the left and those who are positioned on the right, which we should be one people, but okay. Yep. And I think sometimes we forget or we can't acknowledge, perhaps including myself, that there is what we say and the theory and the philosophy of what we say and then the actual practice and the reality of things. And so I think when we say that it's a class thing, what we're really saying is there has been a major, major shift in geopolitical, economic development across the planet where it was not before the case. And so I would like to think, you know, I want equality for all, but equality for all means I have to give up a few things, because now actually the rise of the economy in China and in Vietnam and Indonesia and all these Southeast Asian territories means that, well, they won't be those people that come and work for pippins and they practically enslave them for nothing, yeah. Or that when we travel, our currency is not as strong as it used to be. These things cause discomfort for people. And that really is a strong part of this unsettling feeling. And we need to identify that feeling. We need to identify and acknowledge that, again, equality does mean that some things need to be given up, and you have to believe that it's better for humanity, for us to thrive for a more equal society across the planet, than to obviously have disparity in one region so that another region can have prosperity. And so I think it's a tough conversation for one to have to oneself. Then from there, one could really connect with others.
You know, I always come out of these episodes with artists who, whether they're directors or choreographers or people who are performing for us to see, there's always this root of activism. There's always this understanding of we need to inspect deeper power dynamics and structure. And I wish that I was in London to experience this personification, this of what's in your mind, this public visual display of exquisite noise, as you've talked to me in the last few minutes about the political nature of the UK and the world now. Thank you for coming on the Vietnamese podcast to share your journey. And I really wish that I could be there to witness it.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. And yeah, it's a pleasure to meet you as well. Again, I'm a huge fan after doing a deep dive into your work. And I think it's really important and urgent. And also it's really nice to see the Vietnamese community taking very different positions and their practices. So yeah, thank you very much for this opportunity.
Yeah, it's truly my pleasure. And I've said this to other people from the UK, Vietnamese, like Duyet. I would like to see many more Vietnamese from the UK come on to the podcast, and I'd love to invite you back, you know, your next show, and, you know, or just to kind of even talk on a panel with Vietnamese from the UK. I think it's a blessing to have all of you there too. It's like family.
Yeah, amazing. Well, thank you. Yeah, it's a pleasure to connect. And anytime, please do drop me a message. I'm always around.
Thank you, Dom.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.